I'm Ken McLeod. We have designed and continue to refine unfetteredmind.org to make it easy for you to access our podcasts, translations, articles, and transcripts. But websites cost money to maintain and update. Our free content is only possible because people like you make donations. So if you find our materials helpful, please go to unfetteredmind.org/donate. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, the nuts and bolts of ethics and actions.
Today, we begin the discussion of ethics associated with taking and sending. Now, there are a couple of points that are probably worth noting about ethics in general and Buddhist ethics in particular, and maybe a few other things too. I think in the larger picture, the question of ethics, or the whole subject of ethics, arose because it was how a society sought to govern the behavior of people so that the society could actually survive and wasn't torn apart. We aren't the least bit concerned with those ethics, or that sort of ethics. Buddhist practice ultimately is asocial, and it wouldn't be too much of a stretch to argue that it was also amoral. Because the role of what we are calling ethics here is not about acting in such a way that we hold society together or we don't contribute to its disintegration. That is of actually no concern. It is how do we comport ourselves in our lives to support the practice of waking up or being awake. So there's a very, very different approach, a very different understanding. An example of which many of you have probably have read in my book come into a situation, you know what the right thing to do is, it's going to cost you something, maybe it'll cost you some money, maybe it'll cost you your job, maybe it'll cost you a friendship. But you know what the right thing to do is, and you do it. How long do you think about it afterwards? The answer is not at all. What if you don't do it? And then you think about it a lot. And this is the essence, in my mind, of the Buddhist approach to ethics. It's how do we comport ourselves in our lives so that our mind is clear, open, and awake, and is not disturbed or distracted by reactive processes and emotions and things like that. So that's one piece. Second piece is that, in Buddhism, even though they're not always worded this way, or even taught this way, the moral injunctions are primarily descriptive, not prescriptive. By that, I mean, when you read these lists of do this and do that and do this and don't do that, they're describing how a person who is awake actually behaves. And this fits with what I was saying earlier about the difference between modern and traditional societies. In that, in a traditional perspective, the way that you realize your potential, your spiritual potential in our case, as a human being, is by emulating examples or past examples of perfection. So these descriptions become very important because then we emulate that behavior and moves us in the right direction. The emphasis on individualism in American society in particular, and some other societies in the world, and the peculiar quirks of the American archetypes, namely the Puritan and the cowboy, put most of us in a relationship with ethics that is one of conflict. You know, nobody's going to tell me what to do. And then at the same time, we're vying to be completely pure in our practice, but nobody's going to tell me what to do. So you have the Puritan and the cowboy. Yes?
I'm confused about the difference between prescriptive and descriptive. Can you give us an example?
Well, prescriptive means you do this, you do this, you do this. And the Ten Commandments are prescriptive, okay? Descriptive is, this is how a person who is awake is likely to behave. This is what it looks like. They don't kill, they don't tell lies, that. And then it's up to you what you do. But now you have the example.
So the long list of vows that monks and nuns have to take are considered descriptive rather than prescriptive?
The intention, and that is absolutely true of those vows, is that this describes how an awake person behaves. And so that you don't see an awake person frivolously dancing and singing. So that's why there's precepts is not to dance or sing. Now, I need to correct something here. As you say, there is a long list of precepts, and for a fully ordained monk, it's something like 253 or 256, depending on the tradition. But in the actual ordination ceremony, you only make 5 commitments. The rest are guidelines. And the ones that are regarded as very serious offenses, and the ones who are regarded as moderately serious offenses, the ones regarded as so-so offenses, and then ones regarded as just minor offenses, and then very minor offenses. And it's all laid out like that. But the actual vows, vow is really not the right word. In the Vajrayana level, it's totally different. Well, I suppose vows, okay. It's ordination that's the wrong word. You say in the presence of, in the case of monk's vows, of an abbot, I will not take the life of a human being. I will not steal anything of value, which is defined as a week's supply of rice. I will not lie about my spiritual attainments. I will not have sex, in the case of a monk or a nun. And I will not take anything that has been fermented. That's the vow against intoxicants. Those are the actual vows, the promises, and you just say, these are the actions that I'm going to refrain from. That's what the ordination ceremony consists of. Everything else are guidelines for behavior, which is about holding the community of the monks together in a way that was supported awakening. Okay?
So those five are prescriptive.
And the rest are?
Well, those five are promises you are making to yourself. You know, you aren't making them to the abbot. You're making them to yourself. You're saying it in the presence of the abbot, but you're saying, this is how I'm going to live my life. You feel the difference? That's very important. Okay.
This question is from Matthias in Luxembourg. Why compassion and not indifference? Put another way, what is the basis for Buddhist ethics? I find many of the statements and explanations about Buddhism entirely logical and relatively easy to follow, even from a purely conceptual position. However, when it comes to fundamental questions about ethics and compassion, I fail to see why one or the other should naturally arise. That leaves me with the minor problem of feeling right about being compassionate or practicing loving kindness, but being unable to justify it in a way that appears conclusive and final. Surprisingly, there seems to be relatively little discussion of ethics in Buddhist circles, at least so far as I can see from the literature. You had a nice and helpful passage on compassion in one of your podcasts. It seemed to say something along the lines of, "Act as you feel compelled to in light of your insights and understanding of emptiness. This is called compassion." I hope I'm not oversimplifying things here too much. If my paraphrase is even remotely close to what you meant to say, then, again, why should I feel compelled to act one way or the other?
Well, it's very interesting to hear you say that you find relatively little discussion of ethics in Buddhist circles, because historically, at least, ethics or morality has been the basis for Buddhist practice. By adopting a code of ethics, one learns the discipline, ways to act, ways not to act, and that practice of restraint then becomes the basis for meditation practice, which matures into wisdom. So we have the three, what are called the three baskets, or the three vessels in Buddhism, the Tripitaka, the training in morality and ethics, training in stable attention or meditation, and training in wisdom or understanding. Now, the next thing, why should I feel compelled to act one way or the other? Because of our background in Western approaches to ethics, we tend to regard morality as being prescribed. That is, we are being told how to behave. But in Buddhism, we tend to see discussions of ethics as more descriptive rather than prescriptive. By that I mean, when we read these accounts of what constitutes ethical behavior, they're describing how a person who is awake and present behaves. They aren't describing how a person should behave. So a person who is awake and present naturally speaks gently, says what is true, refrains from harming others, takes care of what arises in mind, doesn't act on malevolence or envy. cultivates loving kindness and compassion. This is what an awake person does. And you may say, well, why do they do that? And I think the answer is very simple. Because when we do these things, the mind is at peace. Consider a situation. You know what the right thing to do is, but it's going to cost you something. It may cost you some money. It may cost you some embarrassment or some pride. Maybe it costs you a friendship. Maybe it even costs you a job. But you know what the right thing is, and you do it. How long do you think about it afterwards? When I ask people this question, most people look at me somewhat puzzled and say, well, you don't think about it afterwards. You know it's the right thing. That's it. You don't think about it much. And I think that's true. But what if you know what the right thing to do is in this situation and you don't do it? And then people say, well, yes, you really think about it afterwards. You regret it, sometimes the rest of your life. This, I think, is the basis for Buddhist ethics. It's not about being good. It's not about obeying some divine law or some set of rules that has been handed to us. It's about acting in the world in a way which causes no regret or disturbance in ourselves, so that mind and heart are quiet and at peace. No one compels you to act this way. You do so out of your own volition, because it's how you want to be in the world. And there's nothing more to it than that.
This is from Thomas in Ohio. A commitment to service, as expressed in the Bodhisattva vow, is integral to practice. But as one practices, awareness increases, and one sees that the prevailing political currents reinforce ignorance and suffering. For example, in the U.S. federal budget of recent years, military to educational spending has a ratio of around 5-1. One feels compelled to step in and address these pathological tendencies. However, it seems that if one enters into the arena of political activity, it could make a person complicit in the very ills that one is trying to eradicate. This seems unacceptable. But on the other hand, passivity or non-involvement also seems unacceptable. So how does one resolve this dilemma? One is in the world but not of it. What is the relationship between practice, service, and political engagement?
Well, Thomas, it feels like you've constructed this question very carefully and puts you in a box from which there's no exit. If I were a Zen teacher, I would probably just say, good luck. My suggestion is, rather than trying to reason this out, because just from the way you've worded the question, reason is not going to be particularly helpful to you, because you're very intelligent and you can construct and view different points of view and different arguments. And probably anything I would say, you'd say, well, what about this or but that? So I'm not going to go there at all. I'm just going to say, trust your heart.
This is from Ryan in Baltimore. My question is about how someone can have a serious meditation practice, yet not necessarily experience significant change in his life. After 2 years of monastic practice, I observed that when intensive meditation and formal practice were reduced in intensity or stopped altogether, the old reactivity was still relatively unchanged. Also, I've observed many practitioners of 20-plus years who do not appear to be any more developed in terms of compassion and insight than some people I know who have zero Buddhist training. This is somewhat discouraging. I wonder if the path-focused approach has serious limitations because it has a strong tendency to keep the practitioner in a subtle holding pattern. I'm advancing, or I understand this on a deeper level than before, or just, I'm still a jerk after all these years. Or perhaps the lack of serious progress is due to not having enough personal contact with a high-quality teacher. Or perhaps it's just that these practitioners, me included, were not in a place where they were able to implement good instruction. Despite this doubt, I would never stop my practice, which is going on 10 years. My question is really about finding an effective approach to practice, questioning, and working with awareness and reactivity. I'm drawn to your pragmatic approach and would like to hear more about it.
A lot of us, I think, have observed the same things that you note in your question. And there are many possible responses here, but let me just go through your question, responding to some of your observations. After 2 years of monastic practice, I observed that when intensive meditation and formal practice were reduced in intensity or stopped altogether, the old reactivity was still relatively unchanged. Well, this suggests two things, possibly. One is how deeply entrenched reactivity is. We can bring a great deal of attention, and as long as we're maintaining the practice, things are okay, but when we let it go, and it suddenly seems to be there again. It could also indicate that the way you were practicing wasn't as effective as it might be. Now, I want to be careful about that because in my own experience, it's taken me years to learn how to practice in a truly effective way. So I think it's a combination of both. One is learning how to practice effectively. And secondly, that reactive patterns are very, very deeply conditioned, and they are not resolved or dismantled easily. I'm mindful of a Zen teacher who was once asked, you've practiced Zen for 30, 40, I don't know how many years it was in the story, what difference have you noticed? And the teacher, Zen teacher, stopped and thought for a while, and he said, I used to be like a tiger. Now I'm like a kitten. But you'll notice that he's still a cat. So that's something to consider. And yes, you can have people who practice for years who it's not clear what benefit their practice has on them or what effect their practice has had. There are a couple of things here. One is they may not be practicing in a very good way. They may be, if they're resting in meditation, resting in a state of dullness, which they think is meditation. That's something that is regularly warned about in the Tibetan tradition. It's called woodchuck meditation.
because woodchucks are able to hibernate, and they're very still for long periods of time, but they aren't particularly enlightened when they wake up in the spring. The other is that they may actually have very good meditation practice, but not have any experience or familiarity about how to live that practice or how to work with the emotional material of lives. That is, mixing their meditation practice with emotional reactivity. And that's something that is very important. My own view of meditation, it's like where we train the abilities, develop the capacity, particularly in attention, so that we can begin to experience our emotional reactivity in attention, which means that our relationship with it changes very significantly. We no longer identify with it. It becomes something that moves through us, and thus we're able to let it go more and more readily until eventually we're able to let it go at the moment that it arises. It may have something to do with what you say, the path-focused approach that you mentioned. I think path is very important, but one of the things that I've noticed is, in the Tibetan tradition at least, one comes away that there is the path. And lately I've been thinking more and more along the times, it's not so much a case of following the path, but finding a path. And it's our path in this experience that we call life. And what is the aim? It is to be able to live that life fully without struggle. And struggle is one way that we could define suffering. And that's the only aim of Buddhism, to be able to live our life without struggle and without causing struggle or suffering for others. All of the categories of various meditation states and paths and levels and things like that naturally leads to some notion of I'm advancing or I understand this on a deeper level than before. But that's my own experience here is that as we our practice matures, as it becomes more and more part of us, we see situations more clearly, and thus our actions are more appropriate. So, but the result of that is that things just seem to happen naturally. They don't seem to be any big deal. So it doesn't feel particularly special. And so I don't see what one, there's anything really to form an identity about as one is an advanced practitioner, or that one is deeper in some way. That way of thinking feels foreign to me. However, I can certainly relate to I'm still a jerk after all of these years, because you hit a situation, stuff comes up that you have not experienced in attention, and bang, yes, you are a jerk after all these years. But in that experience, one's just identified the next area to direct one's attention and practice. Lack of serious progress is due to not having enough personal contact with a high-quality teacher. Perhaps a good teacher certainly is able to focus one's attention and help one develop skills. It's really worth the time and energy to find a good teacher and to meet with him or her regularly. That's just a really good idea. You suggest the practitioners were not in the place where they were able to implement good instruction. Well, we all have our own situations, and that's where we have to find our practice. And so that's part of the challenge of practice, is creating a situation in our life where we can actually practice. I find it very interesting that you close this with the saying that despite this doubt, you'd never stop your practice. So obviously it means something to you personally. I would advise you to continue to explore whatever you're finding of value in practice. Find your own way so that you can live a life free of struggle and or find ways possibly to help others. And don't be too judgmental of other people, because we're all the same in this. Each of us is struggling or striving to find our way. One of the things that I find most helpful is to remember that everything everybody ever does is because at that moment they feel it will make their world better.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.